from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, charges of chemical use in Syria, sequestered air traffic controllers and snarled airports, and charges and funerals in the Boston bombings. In Abu Dhabi, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel pointed cautiously to evidence of chemical weapons use in Syria. The president has called that a red line. Here's Hagel.
The U.S. intelligence community assesses with some degree of varying confidence that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons on a small scale in Syria.
The Senate moved to act as the sequester hit air traffic controllers and flights jammed.
This morning, the sequester is walloping airports again.
There are 39 delays and actually two cancellations.
Arrivals were delayed an average of 77 minutes last night.
And memorials and funerals this week in the aftermath of the Boston bombings. Thousands gathered in Cambridge to remember slain MIT police officer Sean Collier. The vice president was there. So was Collier's stepbrother, Rob Rogers.
People have asked me if Sean were here, what would he think? Are you kidding me? He would love this. You got sirens, flashing lights, formations, people saluting, bagpipes, taps, the American flag. He would have loved it.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of National Journal, Meredith Shiner of Roll Call, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What's your top story this week? What do you see in Syria, in the Boston bombing charges, in Twitter hacks, and the U.S. economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in Washington, Meredith Shiner, staff writer for Roll Call. Meredith, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me, too.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Meredith.
Michael, take us right to this Syria question, if you will. All these kind of equivocations as Hagel talks about the thing that's supposed to be the red line itself. So where are we here? The White House is putting out words saying, unnamed sources saying, no, not yet. We don't know. And yet it was a choice for the White House to send this letter to Congress saying there appears there has been use, though we've got, various opinions in different intelligence agencies. Where does this stand, Michael?
At a critical point, Tom, this is really high pressure for the Obama administration. Obviously, the president said last summer that chemical weapons use would be a red line for him. He reaffirmed that just a month ago during his visit to Israel when he described it as a game changer. But the administration still seems to be somewhat hesitant, as it has been all along, about intervening in this terrible conflict that's already cost more than 70,000 deaths, because it's a very difficult situation. Going in and helping the rebels could lead to the rise of political Islam in that country in the same way we've seen in Egypt and elsewhere. And that's really, I think, the primary concern. And, the first step is possibly leads you to a slippery slope. I think that's the fear. John McCain and others who have been calling for a long time for some more type of aggressive intervention, including a no-fly zone, jumped on this latest news. But the administration, in conversations with reporters yesterday, of whom I was one, said that it needed to do a lot more research before it was ready to make a decision.
But it was a choice to come forward with this. I mean, the president, yes, of course, he's been on the record for a long time now, repeatedly saying major consequences for the use of chemical weapons in Syria. In Jerusalem last month, called, as you say, Michael, called the use of chemical weapons a game changer. At the White House last year, a red line. Here's the president.
The use of chemical weapons is a game changer.
That's a red line for us, and that there would be enormous consequences.
And as you say, Senator John McCain, right on top of this yesterday, as the White House came out with these new charges with all kinds of caveats, but McCain ready to say, let's go and do a lot of things.
Provide a safe area for the opposition to operate, establish a no-fly zone, and provide weapons to the people in the resistance who we trust.
Who we trust, and that, of course, is a big deal. Meredith Shiner, how is this being received on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think Michael is right in that the senators who have always advocated for more intervention in this area have used this as an excuse and or reasoning to continue that stand. I mean, John McCain has felt this way about several countries, not just Syria. He was very supportive of arming rebels in Libya. So this is a position that has been longstanding of his. But you asked a question, why should the administration come forward with this information?
Yes.
And I think it's something that we're seeing that's quite interesting in this second term of the Obama presidency, is that he's making a little bit more of an effort to reach out to Congress across the board. And I think that this was an example of this, because if you remember last spring, when a series of stories with intelligence leaks were published in a variety of publications, including the New York Times, there was a strong resistance from Congress, and there was a lot of frustration, actually, from people like Senator Dianne Feinstein, who runs the Intelligence Committee, and her counterpart in the House, that they weren't getting this information. They were reading it in newspaper first. And I would imagine that part of this is maintaining those relationships with Congress and making sure that this news didn't get to senators who should know through the media first. And so I think that this was one of those steps that they were taking in order to make sure that they were keeping senators abreast. But of course, as you noticed, and this can cause some problems for them, because there will be senators who will want them to have a much more aggressive policy versus those who are taking a more tempered approach. If you look at Dianne Feinstein's statement from yesterday, she was talking about the UN Security Council and how they should get involved. I don't know that that would be what John McCain would advocate. So it's going to create a little bit of a mess, but certainly senators were paying attention. There was a full briefing yesterday with security officials in the Congressional Visitor Center in one of the auditoriums there, and so certainly they're paying attention.
Pressure to say something, maybe, Jack Beatty, when Israel came out this week saying that, asserting that the Syrian army had used lethal chemical weapons in the civil war there. France, Britain, disclosing that the credible evidence they've said Syria's using chemical weapons. But a funny combination here, Jack, of raising it in the mouth of the White House and of the Secretary of Defense, but then with all these caveats around it, varying degrees of confidence. Chuck Hagel saying in Abu Dhabi, saying that there's a lot we still don't know. Here's the Secretary.
We still have some uncertainties about what was used, what kind of chemical was used, where it was used, who used it.
That is indeed, Jack, a lot of uncertainties when what we're talking about is a presidential statement earlier of a red line that would, the suggestion was, bring potential significant American intervention.
Yes, U.S. credibility, the president's credibility on the line because of the president's own statements. And there are equivocations even in the letter sent to Congress. So you mentioned the some degree of varying confidence.
Wow.
There's also,
what a phrase.
Right. There's also the letter also says that the use or the purported use of chemical weapons may have been, quote, on a small scale. Well, the significance of that is that last August, the president's, his red line, he said the red line for us is when we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized, whole bunch versus small scale. So you see a hedge built right into it there in the current response. And I'm reading in Wired, I don't know what our colleagues from Washington know about this, that the sample, our going along with this is from a sample taken by the Syrian opposition groups from alleged victims. And, of course, that's very difficult to do. But as everyone points out, that's a murky chain of custody. They have every motive in the world for wanting us to intervene in that struggle. And it is noteworthy that in Iraq in the 90s, I think it took something like 4 years for Doctors Without Borders or one of those groups, Physicians Responsibility, Social Responsibility, to actually confirm that Saddam Hussein had used poison gas on a wide scale. That took 4 years to get in there and measure and so on. Well, we don't know whether we're in any sort of scenario like that.
But it doesn't seem like a four-year kind of timeline we're on. Michael Hirsch, so many outs the Secretary of Defense has left himself here. You know, we don't know what kind of chemical, we don't know where it was used. Most importantly, we don't know who used it. But what about the issue of scale itself? Would it have to be a lot of chemical weapons used? Where is this red line? Would even a little be the credibility point for the White House or not, Michael?
Well, the red line looks like it's getting pinker. I mean, it is true that the president did leave himself that one out, among others, in terms of saying a lot versus little. They're saying small scale. The technology is much better to determine this. But I think the only fair reading of this, if you look at that letter to the senator, is if you look at Hagel's statements and what has been said by administration officials since, you know, they're starting to contradict themselves a little bit on this. You know, they said very clearly in that letter, chemical weapons used by the Assad regime. So why are they now focused so much on chain of custody if they've already determined that indeed this comes from the Assad regime and is not something that was sort of planted there by the Syrian rebels who, yes, granted, do have high motivation to paint the Assad regime as black as possible. So I think, you know, this is a situation. The backdrop here is an administration that devoutly wishes to stay out of Syria or any other Middle East conflict. This is a president who really didn't even want to get involved in Libya. He was prodded into that, you know, by his Secretary of State, then Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice as UN ambassador. He's made clear in really kind of repudiating even the recommendations of his own CIA and National Security Council that he wants to stay out. And I think that's really what's going on here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, chemical weapons and Syria, air traffic fury, a big Twitter hack, and charges, and more details in the Boston bombing case. Meredith Shiner is with us from Roll Call in Washington. Michael Hirsch with National Journal there. Our own Jack Beatty's here. I want to bring our listeners right in on Syria. Lots calling on that. Brandon in Burlington, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Brandon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question was just in regards to the Syrian opposition possibly have staging this event or having some sort of hand in the event, it seems like they stand to gain quite a bit from having the West jump in on their side. And as awful as it might be, we might have to consider the fact that they might have had some sort of hand in this event or agents within that resistance group. Yeah,
very complex motives here. Jack, that's what you were pointing to, I guess, in citing the Wired report. What do you say? And everyone's looking to I don't know if the right word is play the United States, but maybe we saw this big push by the Assad regime in Damascus this week to say, don't mess with us or you're going to have an Al-Qaeda Syria.
Right. They were trying to improve relations with the United States. Well, on the chain of custody, Wired quotes a chemical weapons expert saying it would be very, very difficult to fake it. Not only would they need the wherewithal or to steal it or brew it up themselves, they'd need volunteers who would notionally agree to a possibly lethal exposure. So if it's a blood sample, someone would have had to agree to have their blood somehow doctored with this. Point is, it could be done, but it would be difficult, very difficult. It's certainly the case that they would like us to intervene. On the other hand, you know, we're not the only ones. The British have, I think there's something a good number of they have testimony at any rate, and they claim that they have some sort of verification of people in hospitals. They have verbal representations and so on. The Israelis have their source of evidence, so it's mounting up. And it may be just even beyond by this point, this particular blood set.
Let's get one more. Al in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Al, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. It seems that the Secretary of Defense is following in the footsteps of Mr. Kerry and his trip to the region, although it's very admirable. It seems to me that it's raising the tensions in the region. And I'm not sure, I'm not a diplomatic analyst, but there's a lot of bluster and a lot of bravado involved, but I think at the end of the day, the U.S. may lose its credibility if they talk and do very little.
Meredith, what about the credibility question here? And could this be a brushback against Damascus? Worried that they might use things and saying, we're really focused on this. Look how close we are to the red line. What about credibility and the impact of these statements, Meredith?
Well, I think that what I'm looking to see also next is what the international community does. As you said, that there was some British intelligence that corroborates this. I believe that there is also some French intelligence that's out there saying similar things to what we are getting. And I'm curious, based on what we did on Libya, because we really encouraged NATO to take the lead and we supported them with our funds and arms, I wonder if we're going to wait to see what some other countries do. I don't see the president wanting to get out ahead on this. They've been avoiding getting engaged in Syria for quite some time. And then the threatening about getting close to this red line, I think that they're going to wait or at least communicate with some of our other allies to see how to proceed on this. And well, I think that that's part of the credibility question, even in the international community.
Of course, they helped put it front and center this week. Dennis in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Dennis.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the air.
Yeah.
And I think President Obama is wise to wait. And by waiting, he increases our credibility. By getting out in front in Iraq, we went to the United Nations on a curveball witness that was questionably treated and made up stuff that justified our attack in Iraq. Well, let the United Nations come to us. And when they come to us and say, we can't take this anymore, hey, friend, do something about this. And then when we do something about it, our credibility goes up. Our credibility went down when we made up stuff about Iraq and invaded them for business purposes.
Dennis, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. At the same time, Michael Hirsch, I mean, quite true about the road into Iraq, but we heard this active conversation in Washington the last week saying, look, this thing may be going over to an Islamic fundamentalist state if we're not careful here, and people in Washington worried about that. Makes you wonder if they were perhaps bringing this information forward because they're worried about this going in a way that could be very unsettling for the U.S. and ally Israel in the region.
Unquestionably, and I would just add that the French themselves, and the French have been the most aggressive Western government in urging military intervention of some kind, especially arming the rebels, were saying as of yesterday that they themselves do not have any conclusive evidence as yet about the use of sarin or other chemical weapons. So, you know, there might be reason for caution here. The other thing that's going on, of course, and this is what Chuck Hagel hinted at in his remarks yesterday, is they are trying to create an airtight case that they can go into the UN and Security Council with, get a beefed-up resolution. The background here is Russia, who has been Bashar Assad's chief ally, has been the main holdout in the UN Security Council with, of course, a veto. And I think that they are hoping that they can make the case better, perhaps even bring Russia along in terms of gaining international authorization through the UN for some kind of greater action. That has always been Obama's threshold here. It certainly was the way they went at the Libya problem, not only using NATO in the lead, but also using UN authorization. So that's the game that they're playing right now.
We'll go to one more on this and move on. Tara in Gallatin, Tennessee. Tara, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that the Boston bomber did mention that may have incited their aggression toward Boston was the possible the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm just terribly worried that the more we get involved in this region, the more we may possibly incite other attacks against our country and therefore somewhat, you know, cutting off our nose to spite our face.
Yeah, potential blowback from the most unexpected quarters and when you least expected as well. Tara, thanks for that call. I mean, Jack, this is interesting that, you know, Tara worrying about getting involved because look what can happen back here. Here's another interesting one. Leanne writes online. She says, I think we're entering a very precarious period because the media is on hyperspeed while our government clings to secrecy and cliches. It's fodder for all sorts of conspiracy theories. Once we enter this world, there are no conversations, only accusations. And boom, we can be pushed forward by that sort of spinning ball of speculation and, you know, red line crossed or not crossed, who knows?
Oh, my, that point about the media as a vector, really, for, you know, involvement and fear and, you know, what's going on, when are you going to, and the different sort of pulses of the media and the government, that's all so well taken. And really, we saw that, didn't we, in 2002, where the media was out there and in some cases was influenced by the administration to keep, you know, putting on the pressure. And I think we're going to keep hearing that over this weekend. Senator McCain, Senator
Graham, I'm sure, will be on the TV over the weekend saying, we've got to get in, we've got to get in. And there's going to be pressure, but this is the president's second term. He doesn't have to answer to, you know, to an electorate, and I'm not even sure if an electorate would think about this. And his caution throughout, you know, has been, as Michael said, he overruled. He said no to his whole security apparatus. Not going to do it last summer when they asked him to give weapons to the rebels. And, you know, recently one of the rebel groups, the leader, I think, of al-Nusra, or one of the leaders, came out and said, our policy, we are pledged to al-Qaeda. Well, suppose we had been giving weapons. And the lead element in the opposition said, we are with al-Qaeda. It would have been a huge scandal. The president has proceeded cautiously for political reasons, and probably that's the best thing.
Tara turns our attention as well to the Boston bombings, and of course this has been a big week on that front. Charges early in the week, weapon of mass destruction, potential death penalty for Jahar Tsarnaev, who has been moved out of the downtown Boston hospital now to a military facility 40 miles west of Boston, and this news coming out just in the last 24 hours, police saying that the suspects in the bombing were talking about going on to New York and doing more bombing there. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg picked up on that right away yesterday.
Last night we were informed by the FBI that the surviving attacker revealed that New York City was next on their list of targets. He told the FBI apparently that he and his brother had intended to drive to New York and designate additional explosives in Times Square.
And at one of those memorial services this week for slain MIT police officer Sean Collier in Cambridge, Massachusetts, surrounded by that sea of police and many others, here was the Vice President, Joe Biden, talking about the origins of this attack and the two suspects in very, very tough terms.
Why, whether it's al-Qaeda central out of the Fatah or two twisted, perverted, cowardly knockoff jihadis here in Boston, why do they do what they do?
Twisted, perverted, cowardly knockoff jihadis here in Boston. The vice president going to very hot language at a memorial service right there. Michael Hirsch, first on this report that they were headed on to New York. This comes from conversation they had, we're told, when they had carjacked a car across the river from Boston, the carjacked driver still there and overhearing this. How are you hearing these reports of what's coming out from Jahar Tsarnaev and from those earlier conversations? How seriously do you take this, Michael?
Well, the reported plan to spontaneously drive to New York and blow up a bomb in Times Square, I think, only adds to the mounting evidence that we've already seen over the past week that these were sort of self-actuated, self-radicalized, perhaps to a degree, guys, jihadis, who were not part of a larger group. We don't know that conclusively yet, but the circumstantial evidence suggests that that was the case. And the fact that they had no escape plan from Boston, that they were just talking between themselves and deciding, oh, let's go blow up some more bombs in New York, indicates that this was between the two brothers. And I think that that's, you know, certainly a relief in some ways. In other ways, it's not, because it suggests that, you know, look on any corner and you could have some self-radicalized guy like the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who just decides that he wants to go out with a bang, literally. And that's scary. I mean, it should be scary. But it does seem like we're heading in that direction very firmly now, that these were guys who are probably not part of any larger al-Qaeda plot.
Let's go to Troy in Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Hey, I got one comment and then a question. One of the deals is Bloomberg asked maybe we should eliminate some of our freedoms and liberties, and I think he eliminated his credibility and with that somewhat statement. But my main question is when will the FBI release the video of the second person planting the bomb, which they said they have? They showed them actually walking. Why don't they show them planting it?
Troy, thanks for your call. I don't know. Michael, can I come to you on this? What about the full record of evidence here? Do you expect to see it? Would it come out only in a trial? They obviously released tape when they wanted help from the public in identifying the suspects.
Yes, but reluctantly, remember, because there was some debate at the time whether indeed what later happened would happen, which is that the subjects would get scared. I think, you know, it was a decision they had to make in the heat of the moment, but it may well be that MIT police officer lost his life because the subjects clearly panicked. I think most of the evidence is going to come out at the trial. The charges against Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the surviving alleged bomber, were, you know, very limited in scope. And so I think it's, you know, silly to begin sort of delving into conspiracy theories at this point as to why they haven't released more video than they have. They are clearly preparing a case right now.
Let's go to Jerome in Decatur, Illinois. Jerome, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to say that I think that we need greater connectivity between our CIA and FBI, because this may have been averted if there had been a little bit more communication between the two agencies. And the other thing, I think this kind of dovetails into the question of our immigration policy. We always look at Mexico, but there are a lot of Middle Eastern people in the country that came on student visas that haven't been properly security checked, and also that they haven't ever gone to the schools. So I think that this is something that we need to look at. I'm enjoying your show. Thank you.
Yeah, Jerome, I appreciate your call. I mean, of course, there is a lot of scrutiny on people coming to the States these days. Whether it's enough, and whether the ball was dropped in this case, I mean, you had South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham jumping on that yesterday, criticizing intelligence agencies for not connecting the dots in a way that would have prevented the Boston bombings. Here he is.
Boston is becoming, to me, a case study in system failure. Just look at it from a 30,000-foot point of view. You have Russian intelligence services contacting two agencies within our federal government responsible for our national security, the FBI and the CIA. They tell us, we believe you have a radical Islamist in your midst.
And not enough follow-up on that, said Senator Graham. Of course, Russian President Vladimir Putin, eager to jump right on that theme, talking with Russian television on Thursday, saying the U.S. and Russia should work together. He's interpreted here by the English language channel RT.
This tragedy should motivate us to work closer together in addressing common challenges and threats.
И опасно является терроризм.
And terrorism
и
is
если
one
мы
of the main
вот действительно будем объединять
Meredith, a system failure here. Those are Senator Graham's words. What do you see?
Remember when the Department of Homeland Security was created so that way we could centralize our intelligence and make sure that our agencies weren't dropping the ball and communicating with each other? That was the stated point of creating this new department. And clearly there are some concerns that there's still a lack of conversation between the CIA and FBI. And I think in the coming days, we'll see how aggressively the CIA was trying to push the FBI to look into this. There's some question of the level of the information they were getting from the Russian government. There was that initial request in 2011. But I had read some sort of reports that said that we had gone back and pressed them for further information, and it seemed like those lines went cold. So I think that that's always a concern when you have this mass of information coming from all of these different places, both domestically and internationally. How do you organize that information in a meaningful way, in an actionable way? And that's something that is continuously evolving, because the ways in which people decide that they want to design attacks or approach these issues is evolving too.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 12 coffins side by side in Waco, Texas, after the massive fertilizer plant explosion. President Obama told grieving mourners there, "You are not alone."
We'll be there even after the cameras leave and after the attention turns elsewhere. Your country will remain ever ready to help you recover and rebuild and reclaim your community.
Charges dropped against Elvis impersonator Paul Kevin Curtis in the case of ricin poison mailed to the president and others. Curtis said he didn't know what investigators were talking about when he was being interrogated.
"Tell us what you know about ricin." I said, I don't even eat rice. Oh, unless I'm at a Chinese restaurant, that's the only thing. And I'm like, it's not in my home. I don't cook rice. I don't really even like it. And they go, "You know what we mean, ricin."
And five presidents, past and present, came together to dedicate George W. Bush's presidential library in Dallas. The honoree spoke about his own legacy as 43rd president.
One of the benefits of freedom is that people can disagree. It's fair to say I created plenty of opportunities to exercise that right. But when future generations come to this library and study this administration, they're going to find out that we stayed true to our convictions.
George Bush and four more presidents, his father, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama in Dallas yesterday. We're looking at a week in the news, chemical weapons in Syria, air traffic fury, a big Twitter hack, and charges more details in the Boston bombing case. Meredith, I want to come to you on this immigration front. There's been a lot of talk about a consensus coming together. Then came the bombings in Boston that got a lot of people's hackles up about immigration. We heard this exchange in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Monday. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York and Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa arguing when Schumer said that some in Congress were using the Boston bombings as an excuse to delay an immigration bill.
I would say to my colleagues, and I understand their views are heartfelt, the chairman has a very open process. So if you have ways to improve the bill, offer an amendment when we start markup in May and let's vote on it. I say that particularly those who are pointing to what happened, the terrible tragedy in Boston, as I would say, excuse for not doing a bill or delaying it many months or years.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did, sir.
Meredith Shiner, do you see a consensus coming together on immigration reform or not? And what about the Boston, is it a hiccup or more? What?
So when you look at that exchange, I think that's sort of indicative of what the double-edged sword of having this open process is. Republicans especially were pushing for regular order on this immigration bill. So you're seeing multiple hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. They're going to mark up legislation that was created by this group of eight bipartisan senators, of which Senator Schumer is one, and then they're going to bring that to the floor. And so when you have these sorts of outside influences, of which there are many, by the way, on this bill, and you have events that could potentially be used to reopen conversations on issues that may have seemed closed, that's what you're seeing with Boston. I think that a lot of the people who came out expressing serious concern about the Boston bombing's link to immigration reform are the people who didn't want to see that bill done in the first place.
Outside influences like what, Meredith? Like
so who? you're seeing new groups get involved in this. I think one of the most fascinating new changes on the kinds of lobbying groups on this immigration bill are these tech firms. Mark Zuckerberg has put together this group of bipartisan strategists, and they're trying to get involved in congressional races to try to lobby in favor of immigration. The question is
how Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook,
yeah.
Because they want to be able to bring in more high-educated, high-tech,
engineering and math. Because a lot of times when we're talking about immigration nationally, we have this focus on some of the low-skilled labor, although there are certainly provisions in this bill that the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO have come to the table and agreed upon. But this high-tech argument is extraordinarily interesting, particularly from an economic perspective. So you're seeing people who ordinarily weren't playing getting involved. But one of the examples of how successful the Zuckerberg group might be is when you look at what Mike Bloomberg did on guns. He funneled millions of dollars into a special election congressionally in Illinois, and it didn't seem to rally up enough support even to pass a watered-down background checks bill. Mm-hmm. You had a moderate Senate Democrats saying, well, we don't want the New York mayor telling us what to do in Arkansas in the case of Mark Pryor, or again in the Dakotas in the case of Heidi Heitkamp. So I don't know exactly how these outside influences are going to play at the end, but it's very much an outside game too, in addition to this regular internal order process.
Jack Beatty, let's back up for just a moment on exactly that point of gun reform and universal registration watered down, Meredith says, but it did not pass the week before, and the news of the bombings rolled over a lot of that. Yet there may have been an echo this week. We heard seven-term Democratic Montana Senator Max Baucus announcing that he would not seek re-election. Here's a little tape. He was talking yesterday on All Things Considered with NPR's Robert Siegel. And Senator Baucus said, Robert Siegel said, look, a lot of Democrats were really upset with your vote. Senator Baucus, now who's going to retire, said his vote against those background checks, he said, was not influenced in any way by worries over a potential primary challenge, maybe backed by Mayor Bloomberg's group, if he had sought re-election.
That doesn't even
into my calculus. I don't think about all that stuff. It just does, it's irrelevant to me. You do what you think is right. And for me, what's right is the votes I took, because that's what the people of Montana want.
Senator Baucus, Max Baucus, retiring. Jack, what do you make of the dynamics around here on the gun vote, which kind of got lost in the blast, and maybe Baucus himself?
Well, on the gun vote, you know, it's interesting. Tom Brokaw, who's from that part of the country, on Sunday on Meet the Press, said, you know, if you look at polls, yes, 90% nationally want universal background checks, but look in these states and you find 10%, 5%. Well, in fact, in Montana, 79% of respondents wanted universal background check. In North Dakota, where Heidi Heitkamp says, I listened to the voters of North Dakota. Well, if she had been, 74% of them wanted background checks. In Arkansas, with Mark Pryor, 72% wanted background checks. So, it doesn't look like these senators cut profiles in courage. It looked more like they were responding to the particular fear of the gun lobby, that, you know, that activated 10% of the electorate could cause them problems. And, you know, you see the public seems to be basically saying, well, it's too bad it's happened, and there doesn't seem to be a huge upset about that, at least according to the recent Pew poll. But here you have in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte, our senator, she's gone down, and of course this is a phone poll, 15 points just in a week, and there's been an organized campaign of letters to the editor and some really tough editorials in the papers here hitting her for this vote. And that's, I think, emblematic of a new politics. And I think, you know, it was touched on, a new politics of guns. And that is, there are people now on the other side. It used to be all on one side. Now, with Bloomberg and with Gabby Giffords, who's now funding ads in New Hampshire against Ayotte, there's a response from the other side.
We'll see what the volume of those voices turns out to be. Michael Hirsch, New York Times, reporting today that there are already talks to revive gun control legislation underway on Capitol Hill. Bipartisan groups, senators, and more looking for a way to bridge differences here. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not just because this remarkable bipartisan effort that went down to defeat between two gun supporters, Joe Manchin, you know, Democrat of West Virginia, and Pat Toomey, Republican of Pennsylvania. And by the way, Toomey has seen his own poll ratings shoot up after he sponsored that failed bill. But also, you know, as Jack was suggesting, I mean, this is a real test of a new politics, and the question of whether what has always been a sort of rule in Washington, which is that, you know, vested lobbying interests like the NRA generally win out against the more generalized national interests because they're just more much more passionate, whether the countervailing passion we're now seeing on the other side, led, for example, by Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot, you know, a couple of years ago in an incident in which six people died, and Michael Bloomberg, who not only has the passion but has the deep pockets. I mean, that's key here. And we'll see it in cases like, for example, this campaign against Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire. I mean, a lot of these calls and these ads did not happen by accident. Bloomberg has made you know, no bones about the fact that he's going to come out and supply a lot of money in trying to defeat some of these senators who came out against the background check bill. And, you know, we'll see that play out. But Jack's absolutely right. I mean, this is going to be a test of whether we have these new groups, these new passions on the other side, and whether they're enough to really counter the gun lobby.
Let's go to Carl in Charlestown, Massachusetts. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Wanted to talk about the sequester.
Yes.
And the airline delays.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that the effect of the total cut to the FAA is relatively small, and the effect seems to be much greater than what you'd think of a $200 million cut. I mean, I'm a small business owner, and if we have to reduce our budget by, you know, less than, you know, 5% or something, we don't cut the essential people, we cut the nice-to-have people.
So what you're saying, don't, if you have to have cuts, don't cut air traffic controllers and snarl the whole system?
No, I'm saying, you know, move the people who produce brochures for the system, you know, to furlough, and not the people who steer the planes.
Yeah, I get it. Absolutely, Carl. I appreciate your call. I mean, Meredith, this gets right to the heart of it. You know, this was a pain point. The Obama administration saw it coming and talked about it very early when the sequester was on the table. Now here it is, and Congress is moving to do something like what Carl's suggesting, to get the controllers back in the towers and take the pain elsewhere. Carl's all for that. Others are saying, John writes online here, he says, the purpose of the sequester was to enact stupid cuts so the government would not allow it to happen. Making the cuts more flexible would reward Republicans who favored cuts. Air travel can't be affected, but less powerful victims of the cuts aren't having their needs addressed. What about this surgical relief for air travelers? Hey, who wouldn't like it if you're traveling? I would want it if I was traveling. But here's the rub, Meredith.
So I see two conflicting issues here. The first is that you're right. People who are business travelers who are waiting in long lines, you see on local newscasts, people who are waiting in lines at O'Hare and DFW, those are the people whose voices are going to be heard most. Or how about senators who have to get on planes every weekend to go home? And so you did see the Senate pass this bill last night to give the FAA more flexibility to administer cuts in the way they see fit. And the House is going to be voting soon on the suspension calendar, meaning that they expect lots of votes for it to pass. But the problem I see for the White House here is that their entire strategy to try to replace sequestration with what they wanted and what they saw as a more reasonable mix of cuts and revenues was that this pressure was going to build on Republicans. And now, for the second time, you see them letting Republicans off the hook. The first was at the fiscal cliff debate. I think you heard a overwhelming consensus of Senate Democrats and congressional Democrats who said they wanted to see the country go over the fiscal cliff because it was their highest point of leverage in negotiations with Republicans. Once they got Republicans to agree to those tax breaks, then there was no incentive for Republicans to come back to the table because Republicans are the party that would actually prefer to see many of these cuts. So again, this is the first time you're seeing another pressure point. And they're releasing it. So I don't know what their long-term strategy is in terms of replacing it. But if they think that everyone's just going to come to the table and agree to some grand bargain, that's failed over and over and over again, whether it was between the president and the Speaker of the House or any sort of negotiating group that emerged in Congress. And so they're in a bind in terms of a long-term policy perspective, because one of the words we don't hear, I think, said enough is austerity. These are austerity measures that our government implemented. And as had been said earlier, was sort of sequestration was designed as a pressure point to get people to come to the table. And it hasn't happened.
Let's go to Susan in Newton, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi. I have another question, comment about sequester. What I'm annoyed about is that the squeaky wheel is getting the grease with respect to the airplane situation. I was just informed yesterday that I'm involved with a project that's funded by USAID in sub-Saharan Africa to train people how to deal with emerging pandemic threats. And I was told yesterday that I'm going to lose a staff and a half, which is going to tremendously impact my ability to run this project. So there's smaller projects that aren't squeaky wheels, that aren't getting any grease, and not getting that conversation that they deserve. And how are we going to deal? Is this a way to create policy only to deal with the things that annoy a lot of people?
Yeah, Susan, we've got it. I mean, that's how a lot of politics work, and we're seeing that right now. But then this whole dynamic was supposed to be everybody would feel the pain, so nobody would want to go down this road. But an exemption's being carved out right now. Depending what time you're listening today, the House may already have passed this to let air traffic controllers back onto the job. I want to look real quickly down to Dallas, where the George W. Bush Presidential Library was opened this week. Jimmy Carter had been a big critic of George Bush, but he, with all the other presidents there, was admiring yesterday in Dallas.
So, Mr. President, let me say that I'm filled with admiration for you and deep gratitude for you about the great contributions you've made to the most needy people on earth. Thank you very much.
Jimmy Carter, a one-time critic, but saying, look, on Africa, on AIDS, on sub-Saharan Africa, George Bush was there. And another really interesting comment from former First Lady Barbara Bush, who was asked by today's Matt Lauer yesterday if she thought her son, Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, should run for president. Here's Barbara Bush.
He's by far the best qualified man, but no, I really don't. I think it's a great country. There are a lot of great families, and it's not just four families or whatever. There are other people out there that are very qualified, and we've had enough Bushes.
We've had enough Bushes. You could see George W. Bush's daughters, just their jaw dropped right there when Grandma put that on the table. Michael Hirsch, how do you think Jeb Bush is going to receive that? He's been talking presidential lately.
Well, he has been. He's been, you know, in and out, and has been for some years now. Of course, we all know the family lore of the Bushes. You know, Jeb was supposed to be the rising one in politics, and W sort of came in, and to everyone's surprise, even that of his parents, apparently, took the presidency. And of course, you know, whatever they said at the library yesterday, most historians view his presidency as one of the most disastrous in American history. So I think for that reason alone, you're not going to be seeing another Bush in the White House anytime soon.
But Barbara Bush speaking her mind, whatever anybody else thinks right there. News just coming in that George Jones, country music legend, has died. We'll watch that. Michael Hirsch with National Journal in Washington. Thanks so much for being here today, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Meredith Shiner, roll call, thanks to you. And Jack Beatty, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.